Welcome to Crosstalk Podcast. Hello, Irene.
Hello, Corey.
We're ready to rock and roll with another Crosstalk Podcast episode.
We're in New York and we have Dr. Jeffrey Katzman here joining us from Silver Hill Hospital Academy of Research and Education. Did that I get it right?
No, perfect. Yeah.
Oh, she is amazing.
S-H-A-R-E, share.
Share, that's what I was thinking in my head. Well, I'm so happy you joined us. You know, there's so many incredibly fascinating things that you have to share with us today. So let's dive right in, right, Corey?
Absolutely.
All right, here we go.
So you're at Silver Hill Hospital. And what exactly is your role at Silver Hill Hospital?
Well, first of all, it's great to be here. Irene, Corey, thank you so much for having me. And it's been great getting to know you before this moment. And my role at Silver Hill Hospital is to direct this Academy for Research and Education that we've developed there, Silver Hill Hospital Academy for Research and Education that we call SHARE. And so we are building a platform to share information with the community, to train clinicians from every discipline, and to provide continuing education about what we believe is really important about being a great provider of mental health care.
So part of the responsibility when Silver Hill hires clinicians is they go through a kind of a special educational process with you, correct?
Yeah, we have medical students and psychiatry residents and then psychologists at every stage of their career and social workers doing internships. And so they get to see what is mental health treatment like on 44 acres with a forest and a river running through it and all aspects of care and an admissions center and inpatient units and then residential houses and then an outpatient program and how this all works and what actually is can be very special about being understood over the course of your treatment.
And how long have you been at Silver Hill?
About 4 years.
That'd
4 years.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. You ever get to interact with the patients themselves?
I do. Yeah, I get to interview them take care of them and have taken care of patients all my life in various capacities before this. Right now, I'm very much focused on training our next generations of outstanding clinicians.
So where did things start in terms of your career? Let's start at the...
Go backwards, yeah.
Yes, the Sound of Music. Let's start at the very beginning.
Yeah, I was a camp counselor, probably started there. Many, many, many times a camp counselor. And I was the first staff at a Ronald McDonald Camp Good Times for a camp for kids with cancer 35 years ago. And in various situations And I liked interacting with people and trying to understand them and what made different kids click. And I didn't really realize at that time that I was in training for something different. And I eventually went to medical school and I went to a village in Sierra Leone, West Africa for a bit and interacted with the people there in a different culture and felt like I just wanted to stay there forever because of the profound sense of connection that people had in the village. And they would dance every night and fall asleep on the grass. And I thought, this is an amazing place. This is where people care about each other and know each other. And that's not what happens in Los Angeles where I was. And I wound up in medical school in San Diego and I was on my psychiatry rotation and I didn't really want to go home. I wanted to cook with the patients. I wanted to hang out and understand them. And I realized I was kind of back at camp trying to understand people and wound up in training at UCLA in my psychiatry residency. And so it's kind of my educational journey.
Underlying that, it seems to me with you described three different locations, mm-hmm. but the same feeling in all three locations. Underlying that, it seems to me that your love of people and of connecting with people was the common denominator in all of that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's what I've really become interested in. And in some kind of unexpected ways, I'm very interested in how we connect, how we disconnect, what happens when we go to war with each other over the silliest things, and how we can reconnect and find our way back to caring about each other. That's what they call disruption and repair. Those kinds of ideas are really, really important to me. And I've borrowed ideas from a lot of different paradigms to try to understand how that works.
You know, in recovery, a lot of times people will talk about when bad things happen, you learn something from it, and it becomes a kind of a jumping off place for a new chapter. Do you think that the disruption serves a good function, or is it always a negative?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're saying is right on, right? Like this whole idea of when we've been through something difficult, if we have what they call post-traumatic growth, and we develop wisdom as a result of that, it's never, you know, it's not great when bad things happen to us, but actually when we learn from them and develop and grow and can help other people, it's a profound experience. And I think life is about that, because bad things happen to all of us. It's part of what happens in life. And the more we wrestle with that and reckon about who am I and ask those questions, I think the more we can help others along the way.
How has your thinking evolved from being a camp counselor to today, besides education and all of that? But has there been any changes, or is it really just the primal connection? That's it, you know?
Yeah, a lot of amazing teachers along the way. And I think really what happened to me was it was during my internship. I was at Harbor General in Los Angeles, and my friend and I had gone to Santa Monica to the Mayfair Theater, and we watched a show because Second City had just moved from Chicago and opened up a West Coast branch in the Mayfair Theater. And they announced that they were going to have this improv training program. And my friend dared me. He said, "Why don't you audition for that?" I said, "Okay, I will do that." And so the next day after work, I went and I stood in line. I think there were like 200 people in the line to get into the improv school. And we had to go through this series of auditions, playing these games like Taxi Cab. And I mean, I remember them vividly. That's how important some of these experiences can be. And I went home, and then those days we had like rotary phones, and the phone rang, and I picked it up, and they said, "You're in. You got into the class." And all I had to do was bring my checkbook the next week and start at level one. I think all 200 people got into the class as long as they had their $65 that they could
right.
pay.
Right, as long as they have a checkbook,
but
you're in.
I felt amazing. Yeah, to get the phone call.
Right.
And I met my first group that was training with a remarkable actress, improviser named Myna Kolb. And she carried us through these different improv exercises. And I would watch her, and her ability to be in the moment and kind of seize the moment in stage and in her interactions with us. And I thought, this is a remarkable person. Improv must do something to your brain. And I started getting really curious about the ideas from improvisational theater and what I was learning about being with somebody on a stage, not having a script, not knowing where we were going, and having to build something together, right. and just relying on our connection, kind of like we're doing right now.
Right.
And we don't really know where we're going, but we're going somewhere. And that's kind of the spirit. And I realized that's what should happen in a psychotherapy, but nobody was really teaching me that. So I got interested in like, well, what are the guidelines for improvisers and how does this work?
And it's about staying present, right? About really
about staying present. It's about saying yes and to whatever's coming. So if I'm up there on stage and somebody tells me my name is David, I don't say, "No, my name's Bernie." That's not how it works. I'm David. And I'm, if they say I'm 69, I'm not 8. We're developing something together by saying yes and acknowledging each other's reality. It's about making your partner look good. So not about winning something, but about building something together and endowing them with characteristics that are fun for the scene. And it's about really just savoring and honoring your mistakes, that mistakes are gifts, and to be able to be in that state of mind that I'm not here to get it right or to be perfect or to entertain, but to be present and enjoy what goes wrong. That's a real gift for like a therapist who's trying to do it such a good job and be perfect.
Right.
But that's not what we want in human interactions. We want somebody to be present and reflective and okay with making mistakes and saying the wrong thing.
And how did you weave that into your psychotherapy?
Yeah, so there was an amazing program that had started at UCLA called the Imagination Workshop, in which they were doing improvisational theater with patients with serious mental illness, who suddenly they had really negative symptoms of schizophrenia and other disorders, but suddenly, when asked to do these interactions and these games, would come to life, and this went into making masks and involving each other in stories they created. And I saw that there's something alive, something coming alive for these people that was critical. So I started to do it at the VA where I was working after my residency with Vietnam veterans who'd been through a lot, had been through an exposure program, but now this was like a welcome home program. I've taken more of an interest in training therapists around doing improvisation and actually not being taught like, here's the manual, here's how you do it, but who are you and how can you bring your full self and learn about that full self through these experiences and then bring that full self to clients through training and improvisation.
It's fascinating. And it's a way to structure connection.
Right, right.
Basically, you're teaching them how to connect using some outside almost fantasy.
Yeah.
And it's instructive for what happens when you get rid of the fantasy and now you can do this in practice.
So one thing that's interesting kind of back to the veterans is it did feel like a gift. It did feel magical that actually people who were seen as kind of psychologically deadened and with these negative symptoms were suddenly alive once they were not living as the character of I am a Vietnam veteran and like this limits me. Of course that is who they are, but it's not all. Once play was introduced, it was kind of amazing what would happen. But what I also learned in these at improv school was they weren't mostly actors in my group. They were plumbers. They were musicians. They were coming from all walks of life. And it was like people were looking for a place to belong. And improv schools have become that. We don't have people entering really the Lions Club or various even bowling leagues now. You know, it was a famous book about kind of the genesis of loneliness coming with the advent of televisions and then cell phones and us hunkering down in our own living rooms and not being involved in any kind of civic organizations anymore. And improv groups are one of those, just like I think AA is, a community, but it's hard for people to feel part of a community. And that did a lot for me in improv, was I belonged somewhere, which was huge. To feel that you belong.
What happens with social media? We're all on our phones. We're all on our computers. We even meetings now, 12-step meetings are Zoomed. Do you have any thoughts on the impact of how this is either enhancing or detracting from our connectivity? Supposedly, all of these things will create enhanced connection.
Well, there's the obvious enhancements that we're on a podcast and hopefully there's people out there that we can have access to. So there's community building that can happen and we can connect with people who we might have things in common with all over the world. So there are these kinds of enhancements. They've become regulators almost. You know, somebody might have sent me something on my phone, so I have to look at it every couple minutes. And so even the idea of a mother gazing at a child for 2.5 minutes, does that even happen when the phone's right there? Like, how is this reshaping our brain? This becomes really important questions, which why for me, actually experiences of actually being with somebody and connecting with them are so critical, independent of phones and social media. And they certainly don't do anything to help us feel less lonely. It is, you know, looking at pictures of people we've known and how happy they are now, or the beautiful things they cook, or whatever it is that we're seeing, or their perfect children, or their holidays. They, you know, it gives us all FOMO, right? We feel like we are not apart. So people actually feel less connected after spending time looking at social media than more connected in general.
It's interesting how it actually can work in two different ways. And crosstalk is seen in 18 countries with
it's remarkable
meaningful yeah. volume, but you know they would never have seen us. But at the same time, maybe while everybody's watching Crosstalk podcast, they're ignoring their children or
right.
or their parents right. or their friends.
Exactly. Yeah, watch it at the right time. Yeah. yeah.
Well, there must be some positives and negatives, right? There must be
absolutely.
I'm sure at one point there'll be a study on how much scrolling on social media is beneficial and then how much isn't, right? Like a time cap. Like if you scroll for 20 minutes, meaningful content, mm-hmm. like that'll be good for you. And then, you know, but there are people who are just like ignoring life and their chores and their responsibilities and everything and just like, you know, getting sucked into this vortex,
right?
Which is, you know, isolating them, I think, right?
Yes. And this is serious business now.
Yeah.
This social isolation we are discovering is no small matter. European countries have known this or cared about it at least far before us. There was a minister of loneliness in England for 30 years. This is a big deal in other countries. A recent Cigna study showed that the U.S., relative to 13 other countries, we are the loneliest people. Over wow. 50% of us rank ourselves at lonely at least part of the day or much of the time. So loneliness, why does it matter? There is a loneliness-related death every 3 minutes,
wow.
Says a study. It's akin to smoking 14 cigarettes a day. It is more responsible for, as a cause of death, than obesity, than substance use, than not exercising. It is serious business. It's related. It increases your cardiovascular risk in terms of stroke by 30%. Your risk of dementia rises. All mental health issues grow tremendously. Autoimmune problems and problems with our GI system grow. It's not good for us.
How is this loneliness epidemic affecting, you know, is the world of psychotherapy seeing this and acting on it in
just
some
starting
way?
Just starting to. You know, it's interesting. Just like substance use, I don't know what to say even more, but like loneliness carries a stigma that's hard to describe. Like it's not like we would easily say to somebody, are you lonely? There's something about that that's intrusive, that's so doctors, primary care doctors will ask you all kinds of questions. Are you being hurt at home? Are you, you know, all kinds of questions about substance use, about thoughts of hurting yourself, but nobody will ask you, are you lonely? Even though they know you're living at home alone, potentially.
Right.
And so there's that. There's just bringing it into our awareness of like, it's an okay thing to talk about. It's going to happen to most all of us. So we should be able to talk about that word as if it's part of life. And yes, I'm lonely and I want a little help with this. And what can I do? So there's that part of it. And historically within mental health care, if somebody was lonely, that wasn't really considered like a psychiatric condition or something that maybe a therapist would have to deal with effectively. But I think more and more we're understanding actually it's a tremendous risk for mental health issues, for addiction, for suicide, for all kinds, like I said, of physical illness. And for people who are using with substance use, it really becomes a vicious cycle, where it can isolate you from others, And then loneliness can lead to further use. And so it really is about how do I connect with somebody to get out of this cycle, because loneliness makes it so much worse.
You mentioned Minister of Loneliness in England, and I think we've talked, and in your book, it talks about in Japan, there's a loneliness epidemic. And so when people are coming forward with the issue of loneliness, what are people saying? I mean, what is the Minister of Loneliness telling people to do? It's not like go join an improv class. Like what are they prescribing?
It's amazing. I went to, was honored to get to go to the first international conference on loneliness in Hull, England, and all kinds of royalty were there. And
everyone was in separate rooms.
Yes, we're all in separate cubicles, exactly. Right, walls between us.
Yeah.
And I was really taken by the different programs that were there. And there was one. There was one program called Andy's Man's Club that's worth looking up.
What's it called?
It's called Andy's Man's Club.
Andy's Man's Club.
Uh-huh. And Andy's Man's Club has some kind of similar feel to AA a little bit. But I think that Andy had killed himself. I don't want to misrepresent it here, but I believe that to be the case. And so, and had been isolated and alone, and wrote a note about that. And so a group of men came together to say, we're not going to let this happen in his honor, I believe. And one group, and I think it was something like there were 450 groups all over England and Scotland. It just has caught on like wildfire, with these rules, kind of like Fight Club, about what you do, what is okay in the man's club, Andy's Man's Club. And we talk and we share our feelings, and they go on these trips. It's a whole intervention for people to not feel alone. And it's so moving and so remarkable, actually. And the people who run it, who I've met, are just incredible people. So I think it's those kinds of movements, as well as thinking about neighborhoods and building and the value of a front porch or benches in a park, and actually how our geography and architecture affects us if we are thinking about our goal is to actually create a connected world.
And have you noticed, because Andy's Man's Club, I can't help but ask, you know, as a woman, is it more common in men than women, since, like, you know, maybe women lunch, or I don't know.
You do know though, right? You do know that women lunch. Right. Women tend to do better at this. Men have greater difficulty kind of making a date. So I think that's where Andy's Man's Club grew from. But I think there are, if you think about it, lots of women's clubs of various kind, not to be gender binary here, but to get.
But it can be real sometimes.
Yeah,
right?
Men particularly who are alone and isolated have much greater difficulty finding a way to connect.
Trying to figure out what it is about loneliness that prevents someone from asking another person whether or not they're feeling lonely. And, you know, my limited intelligence, that's why we have people like you, you know, to speak with. Is it fear that prevents people from asking that question?
Mm-hmm.
And what is the person
afraid
of? Yeah,
it's fear, or it's something about shame. Mm-hmm. I think it's somehow connected to shame that I'm going to be lonely.
Shame on the part of the person that's being asked, or the
both,
person?
That it's a shameful state or something. So that's, you wouldn't want to humiliate somebody by asking them that question. I think it's something along those lines of, like, we should all have lots of friends and that's a successful person. And if you don't, then you're unlikable or something like this. So don't ask.
I think that's what happened when I was younger. Cause I had one friend
exactly.
And we just liked kind of being on our own. And it was like, what's wrong with you that you don't have that many friends? That changed as I grew up, but you know, now I've kind of reverted back to the, I only want two friends.
Absolutely. Right. And we savor those moments alone where we can be with ourselves and not bothered by it. That's equally important, particularly for those of us with introverted kinds of ideas. So, and this, but also we can be alone and connected to something bigger than us, to spirit. So that comes into this this equation also, I think. I also, you know, there's a survival mechanism here. You know, the zebra who's hurt is isolated from the pack so that they won't be attacked by the lion, and he will. So there is a kind of like isolation of the vulnerable that maybe is in our history,
right?
In this way,
sort of like animalistic,
like stigma, right.
Just want to ask you, I'm taking advantage of you right now.
Great.
There are a lot of people that talk about these behavioral therapies.
Uh-huh.
Can you educate me, perhaps us, I think Irene knows more about this than I do, about the different types of behavioral therapies, what the differences are, and why they might be applied in different circumstances?
Yeah. So most of them are great. Cognitive behavioral therapy means that, just to put a sentence to some of them, my thoughts lead to the way I feel and to my behaviors. And if I can get to the thoughts and start to recognize them, then actually I can do better. And another one called dialectic behavior therapy, DBT. Another one called ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy. If I can accept my state of mind and experience and feel it, then I don't have to run from it. These are all very helpful paradigms. The problem is that there's 425 of them, of what they call evidence-based therapies.
Why so many?
Because, I mean, I don't want to get cynical here, but if I can actually create one and prove that it's effective in two studies, then actually I can train you in it and charge you to be certified and develop whole schools around it. And that's not to at all say that they're not effective, but they are very much promoted by our insurance companies because they're short term,
right?
8 sessions, and then you're going to be better. The thing is that most of them, if they're effective, they've looked at like, well, why do some therapists have much greater outcomes? And across therapies, when you actually look at kind of some master therapists, you can't tell what they're actually doing, which one of these therapies, because there are some fundamental common factors involved in all of the therapies that they're going well. And that are things like we agree on what we're trying to solve, on what the problem is. And most that that I'm listening to you and can be moved by you and empathic to you. And that's not a skill that's easily learned. It's to be empathic to another person and not try to solve something for them or give them a worksheet or mm-hmm. or do something, but actually be moved and hold their experience in your mind as another human being is a profound experience that few of us have in our life and are fortunate when that happens. And so these common factors account for like 85% of the impacts of a psychotherapy. So most of us don't go saying, I really need to go see a CPT kind of therapist or whatever. We want to go talk to somebody who can get us and help us with our problems. And yet whole industries have discouraged just that so that therapists are forced into doing some kind of manualized treatment. And that's exactly the opposite of an improvised spontaneous therapist that you would want to talk to, somebody who's present with you. Rather, they have a manual in front of them and they're trying to keep up with it.
So the best advice we can give therapists is to call it CBT or DBT and do what the hell you want to do.
It's a little bit connect. Of that. It's a little bit of that.
And this is very instructive for our listeners and for the people interviewing you.
Yeah, for me too.
I've loved it. And you know, typically at the end of every podcast, I always ask people what they would go back and tell their younger self. But I'd like to try something different, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
You know what? I've never heard smarter words. This is a place, a time. This is what do you want to do?
So What would you go out and tell if you could, you know, knowing that our audience, some of them are in recovery, maybe some of them are families, but whatever it may be, what would you go out and tell people if you could give them a little bit of advice today?
Yeah, I think just one little thing. A couple things I think about.
We'll do a part two later.
Okay, yeah, part one is say hello to the person you're checking out with in the grocery store, or somebody you see when you're taking a walk. Just make a connection, because actually, when someone says hello back, it's wild how you can feel different. And how that there's like a butterfly effect that can carry on into the world. And I think, or drive a different way to work, do something a little unexpected in your life. The thing that you've always wanted to do, do it. It's about kind of bringing a bit of improvisation into your life and breaking the script that has, that we all have, that is our, we rely on to get through the day, but actually something that's novel, that's new, a new adventure is gold. Right. And sometimes that comes just from a hello, or really pursuing something that's important. Then I think this, thinking about the part two would be like the stigma of loneliness compounds that stigma of addiction, right? And so like the degree to which we can kind of wrestle with like, I'm feeling a little bit lonely. I wonder what I could do. And it's okay. I'm not a hurt zebra. I'm just alone actually right now. This is like most people will be at some point in their life. But I'd like to get around that a little bit. How could I do it? Because those things seem like they go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And what I've learned from the session is the best thing you can do when you're in that space is to put your hand out to somebody, shake hands, use your words, say hello.
Exactly.
You know, just connect.
Which, like you said so beautifully, is counter to how we might be feeling in that moment. We may not feel the impulse or the energy to want to do that.
And I think people don't realize what a common thread this is, you know, that more people will probably relate to it than not. And you know, it makes you feel less alone when you know someone else is feeling it. It kind of cuts it in half.
Right.
Great. Well, Dr. Katzmann, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you both.
Really wonderful. And thank you, folks, for listening. Without you watching this, there would be no Crosstalk podcast.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for watching. Thanks for listening.
Smack the bell.
Oh, yeah. We got to remind you.
Yeah.
Smack the bell, follow us, like us, give us your comments. We don't know what to do unless you tell us what you want. So do more of that stuff, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time on Crosstalk Podcast.
Yep. Thank you for joining us today.